Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Kerry Curtis, Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and a member of the club's Board of Governors and your moderator for today's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is being underwritten by the Mineta Transportation Institute. Our focus today is on electric vehicles. Even as the demands of climate change compel manufacturers to innovate with cleaner vehicles, the world's demand for mobility is increasing. We appear to be on the cusp of an unprecedented rise to prosperity of billions of people, most of whom will want the same benefits that we in this country have enjoyed for decades, most notably automobiles. So how well can electric cars help to meet the combined challenge of plentiful vehicles while also reducing greenhouse gases? Can the advantages of electric vehicles outweigh their shortcomings, and will they eventually become the vehicles of choice? Today, we are fortunate to have a panel of experts who will discuss not only the environmental aspects, but also the engineering, market acceptance, and other issues regarding electric cars and motorcycles, and possibly becoming the vehicles of the future. Our panel are Mark Duval, who is Director of Electric Transportation at the Electric Power Research Institute, also known as EPRI. EPRI is an independent nonprofit center for public interest in energy and environmental collaborative research. EPRI does receive funding from its member organizations, many of whom are electric power companies. Dr. Duval is responsible for EPRI's research and development program for electric transportation, including electric, plug-in hybrid, and fuel cell vehicle programs and related advanced infrastructure. He oversees a number of partnerships and collaborations between EPRI and electric utilities, automotive companies, local and federal state agencies, national laboratories, and academic research institutions. Mark's work currently focused on plug-in hybrid electric vehicle research, development, and demonstrations in collaboration with major automotive manufacturers, such as the EPRI Daimler Chrysler PHEV Sprinter Van Program, that's a mouthful, advanced battery system development and testing, electric charging infrastructure, and environmental analysis of air quality and greenhouse gas emissions and characteristics of plug-in hybrids. Prior to joining EPRI, Dr. Duval had the position of Principal Development Engineer at the Hybrid Electric Vehicle Center at the University of California, Davis. He holds BS and MS degrees in mechanical engineering from the University of California, Davis, and a PhD in mechanical engineering from Purdue. Tony Posawatz is Vehicle Line Director of General Motors' new Chevy Volt. Mr. Posawatz has led the development of the much-anticipated Volt and continues to help lead the development of the 2011 production vehicle. And he says that this morning he actually drove one, so it actually exists. He has served as a GM vehicle line director for the past 11 years. In this capacity, Tony and his product development teams have compiled an impressive record of successful, award-winning, and innovative products. Mr. Posawatz's teams have amassed 7 General Motors Chairman's Honors Award awards for excellence and have overseen the development of cars and trucks from concept initiation to production and market launch in 4 different countries. Mr. Posawatz is also co-chairman of the Electric Drive Transportation Association. Jit Bhattacharya is CEO of Mission Motors, whose new Mission One motorcycle is being promoted as the fastest production electric motorcycle in the world. Mr. Bhattacharya started as COO of the company in 2008. And those of you who aren't into corporate speak, that means for chief operating officer. He has an engineering and background, including experience from the product design firm IDEO, and he also holds an MBA from my alma mater, the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Mr. Bhattacharya has been involved with energy and clean tech for over 5 years, most recently as co-president of the Berkeley Energy and Resources Collaborative, where he helped lead the launch of UC Berkeley's new Center for Environment and Energy and Environmental Innovation. He is taking on the leadership role at Mission Motors at a pivotal moment in the company's history as it prepares to bring the Mission One to market and looks to announce new products in its pipeline. And Richard Lowenthal is the founder and CEO of Coulomb Technologies, Incorporated, widely acknowledged as a leader in electric vehicle charging station infrastructure worldwide. And we'll talk about more about what that means during the program. Mr. Lowenthal started the company in 2007. From 1998 until 2007, he was instrumental in starting several companies, including Lightera, Pipel Systems, and Procket Networks. From 96 to 97, Mr. Lowenthal was vice president and general manager of Cisco's Wide Area Network Access Products Division. Prior to that, Mr. Lowenthal worked in the computer industry. He was co-founder and vice president of engineering for Stardent Computers and served as vice president of engineering for Convergent Technologies. Mr. Lowenthal is also a former mayor of Cupertino and has been heavily involved in the nonprofit world. He holds a BS degree in electrical engineering from UC Berkeley. So now we have time for our questions. And so my first question is for Mark Duvall of EPRI. Looking ahead for 10 or 15 or 20 years, as electric cars become much more common, will the demands that they make on the electrical grid be something that we can cope with?
The quick answer is that yes, the electric vehicles, they do place stress on the grid. A typical home in San Francisco in the summertime draws about 3 kilowatts, and if you take that home and you put it in Arizona, it could be 7 or 8 kilowatts. Well, that's right around the range of what electric vehicles can charge at. So it's a significant load. However, the industry and the electric utilities, they have an obligation to serve reliable, safe electricity to homes and businesses, and it's their job to overcome that. So it's their job to deal with it. On the positive side, almost complete electrification of the light-duty passenger car fleet in the United States, however long it might take, would really amount to maybe less than 10% of the electricity that we use in the United States. So on a system level, it's really a very small amount. There are a number of things that I'm sure we'll get to in the questions that you can do about charging vehicles off-peak and timing when they charge and giving utilities the option to work with vehicle owners to turn vehicles off during times of really high stress in the afternoon on really hot summer days that can dramatically reduce that. So the overall effect is really not something that anyone should be concerned about that wants to go buy an electric vehicle. The utilities have coped with residential air conditioning, plasma screen TVs, computers in every home. All of these things place stress on the grid, and then they deal with it. But the goal here with electric vehicles is to integrate them to the system to a level where it's a much smoother transition, where we don't see any stress, and where the investment required to provide electricity to the vehicles is really very small.
Thanks, Mark. And my question for Tony Posawatz is, I've been hearing about the Chevy Volt, it seems like my whole life. Maybe not. A long time. And so the question does it really exist, and when will it be available for sale? And I was told not to ask him how much it will cost.
I won't answer that question. First, thanks very much for joining us here today and having us here with you. I do see some familiar faces in the audience because, Carrie, this morning, a few people in your audience actually drove the Chevy Volt. It was an engineering test vehicle, probably a vehicle that was developed end of last year that was something that we used to make sure we can validate this product to bring this electrified car to the market. Your real question is, are electric vehicles coming? The answer is the Chevy Volt will be in California before the end of this calendar year in a retail environment for sale. We are finishing the final testing and the preparation to build said cars in quantities of thousands of vehicles the first model year, beginning in 2011 in November, And by the middle of calendar year 2011 for the 2012 model year, we'd like to be in a position to build tens of thousands of electrically driven vehicles and really introduce the first mass market electrically driven vehicle to the United States and hopefully export this leading edge technology abroad as well.
Thank you, Tony. Jit, you're the motorcycle guy on the panel. And, you know, when I think about electric vehicles, I just think about cars all the time. So your company is developing an electric motorcycle. What's the potential for electric motorcycles compared to the potential for electric cars?
Well, thanks. Yeah, I am the motorcycle guy. And I think what's really compelling about an electric motorcycle is that there are a number of benefits to electric drive beyond the fact that it doesn't produce any emissions at the tailpipe. These are benefits such as instantaneous torque, the ability to drive to incredible speeds and accelerate so quickly without needing to shift. These are tangible benefits that a motorcycle rider understands in a very visceral way. So what we're doing here at Mission Motors in trying to create the fastest production electric motorcycle in the world is take those benefits, package it into a vehicle that riders can get on, that they can actually buy, that is reliable, that they can take to the track and enjoy. Because a motorcycle, especially here in America, is really a recreational vehicle. It's one that you have to connect to the riding experience in order to justify the purchase. And at Mission, what we're trying to do is create a new riding experience unlike anything that you can get on gasoline.
Thank you, Jit. And Richard, you're the charging station guy.
Indeed.
And tell us how that works and why do you need a network of charging stations?
So you're going to need a new way to fuel your vehicle when you buy one of Tony's or maybe one of Jit's vehicles. And that's our role. We want to be sure that when you're in the showroom and you're considering buying electric or buying gas, you don't worry about the need to charge your car, and we'll take care of that for you. These vehicles are a little different. The first ones coming out will take hours to charge. And the way that works is that you park them 23 hours a day. So generally speaking, when you're sleeping and when you're working, the car is sitting for long periods of time, and you need one of our stations there. So we provide charging stations for those environments. Our company is a little different from what you might expect. Most of our engineers are software engineers because we spend our time doing business software for a charging station infrastructure. These are things to replace what is familiar at a gas station. But, for example, some of the owners of our stations want the drivers to pay for charging their vehicles. So we have a billing system that our station owners can use. And we have applications. For example, when I came up here today, I used a application on my BlackBerry, also available on iPhone, where you put in an address, and it'll navigate you to the closest station to your destination that's not currently in use, so you have a place to charge your vehicle when you're visiting here at the Commonwealth Club. So mostly what we do is try to provide you the tools so that you're comfortable buying electric vehicles.
Thanks. The big thing that I hear about the concern about electric vehicles is what you touched on, Richard, which is the anxiety about running out of electricity. You can run out of gas, obviously, but there are gas stations all over the place. What do you do when your Tesla is out of electricity in Button Willow? So what is the outlook for actually being able to address that anxiety on the part of electric vehicle drivers?
It's a very good question. We have several answers for that. There are two different kinds of situations. One is the commute. So I commute in a BMW Mini electric vehicle, and my commute is about 15 miles. The car has a range of about 100 miles, so I charge in my home garage or at work, and I never have any issue at all. But there is that time when you want to go farther than the battery will carry you. And then there are a number of solutions. There's one that Chevy has with the Chevy Volt, which is called an extended range electric vehicle that once the battery is depleted, it has a generator that keeps the car going for hundreds of miles. So something familiar to all of you. And basically what happens is you switch from my infrastructure to the gasoline infrastructure for the extended road trip. The Tesla Roadster is another model. Their model is put a big battery in there, a battery big enough so that the car will go farther than you want to go in a day, and have one of our stations where you sleep at night, and have one of our stations at hotels, and you're done, because you only need to charge that vehicle when you're sleeping. So there's a few different answers for that problem, but rest assured, we work on it all the time. One of the situations that we have that's a little different is the one here in San Francisco, where there are six times as many cars as garages. So most of the residents here in San Francisco won't have the ability to charge in the home garage. So you'll see our stations, for instance, down at City Hall, at the Civic Plaza there, so that you could charge while you're working. And primarily, people living in this urban environment will charge in an apartment lot or a condominium lot or while they're working. So we have answers for all the situations you may encounter with your EV.
To Richard's point, just to add a little bit, when you can get a second charge in, for example, Richard's spot on relative to the data that exists, how often you really are driving your car and how often the car is sitting. So typically, we'd like to charge the car, any electric vehicle, overnight when you're sleeping, take advantage of that. That's when the grid capacity is low. Matter of fact, the utilities love us to use that capacity. The rates are usually very low. The interesting opportunity is rather than necessarily putting more and more battery on the car, which is expensive, increases charge time, increases mass, increases associated packaging issues with the car, is to provide a secondary opportunity when one is at work. And for some of us, it's 12 hours, and others, it's less than that. So that's another one of the challenges I think we collectively can work on together when we think about, you know, Mark representing the utilities, Richard with the charging stations, and Jit and I as the vehicle providers. I think that's a very, very elegant solution. And then with appropriate grid management, it's something that could, again, take this technology and begin to usher in this new era of electrified transportation.
Thank you, Tony. One of the big benefit of electric vehicles is for reducing the emission of greenhouse gases, at least in my view. And so if you look down the road 10, 20, 30 years, you can envision an electrical grid that's powered by renewable sources, wind, solar, and so forth primarily. That electricity is brought to your home where you charge your electric car, and then you drive that during the day. And so the greenhouse gas contribution of your driving is really close to zero. But in today's real world, the electricity is generated in the U.S. Largely through greenhouse gas, through fossil fuels. So my question for Mark Duvall of the Electric Power Research Institute is, in today's world, what is the real benefit of powering a vehicle with electricity instead of a fuel?
Well, I spent about 2 years of my life trying to answer this question. And if you're... And obviously, we do work for the electric utility industry. Our partner with this was the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is just downtown in San Francisco as well, to represent the environmental community. We kept each other honest. And one of the things that we found during this is that, yes, renewable energy is a very good transportation source and would result in CO2 emissions of a plug-in vehicle being as much as 50 or 60% lower than even the best hybrid vehicle, so very low. However, taken as a whole, even with all of the coal and natural gas and other sources of electricity, there are still some plants that burn oil as a fuel source to create electricity. Not very many, but there are a few. If you take all of that in total, along with the wind and the solar and all the other sources of energy, it's a significant reduction in CO2 emissions, regardless. So we don't have to sit here and think we have to do this vast modernization to the grid. That's actually already taking place independent of whether electric vehicles are here or not. The grid will get cleaner and that electricity will get cleaner. But today, as the first vehicles roll out at the end of this year and plug in, they're going to be significantly cleaner than either hybrid or gasoline or diesel vehicles.
Terry, I'd like to give a little counterpoint if I could. Besides the environmental benefits, there are a lot of other reasons people want these vehicles. And I'm going to let Jit talk about the fun of driving an electric vehicle because he knows all about that. But there are still people that don't believe in the carbon equation and what it means to us and the vehicle's role in that even. But if nothing else, you know, the importation of oil into the United States is a problem. Last year, it was a half a trillion dollar trade deficit that we imported so much oil. So EVs help there too. They're also considerably lower cost fuel. Driving on electricity costs you about 2 cents a mile, and driving on gasoline is more like 14 cents a mile. So it's got a consumer benefit. But the real reason, if you drive one, as I drive an EV, and if you drive Tony's car, or especially if you drive Jit's vehicle, is that they're tremendously fun to drive. You want one of these things. This is not a compromise situation. You're not doing this necessarily to save the planet. You like it, and I'll let Jit take it from there.
Thanks, Richard. For those of you who ride motorcycles, the Mission motorcycle will be the most fun vehicle you have ever driven. But I will actually add one other point to this, and that's a perspective from another country, and that's China. Mission Motors is right now, we are exploring a partnership with one of the largest manufacturers of gasoline motorcycles in China. This is a manufacturer that makes 1 million motorcycles a year, and many more millions of gasoline engines every single year. So why are they interested in electric? Well, we're here in the U.S. talking about the coming electric revolution. In reality, the electric revolution began a while ago. It began on two wheels in China. There are over 100 million e-bikes, these electric-powered, electric-assist bicycles on the road in China. There are over 20 million electric scooters already on the road in China. Cities all over the country are banning the use of gasoline motorcycles and scooters because these two-stroke engines are so polluting. And now we're talking about criteria air pollutants that cause smog in the air, that cause asthma. This is a very real environmental concern today. So the need for electric is more than just reducing greenhouse gases or reducing dependence on foreign oil. It actually helps in China solve a very real environmental problem, if we all remember the concerns that were launched during the Olympics last I think it was 2 years ago now.
Yeah, 2008. Yeah, Jit, so it's interesting that your company, Mission Motors, has chosen to enter the electric motorcycle market at the very high end, and much like Tesla did with their high-end $100,000 sports car, rather than coming in at the low end. But in other countries, it seems like the electric motorcycle is much more of a mass market phenomenon. What's it going to take for the electric motorcycle business to get hot in the U.S.?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it goes a lot to what Tony was talking about with, are electric vehicles coming? Are they here? Where do we really stand in this industry? We've been talking about it for so long. I look at the battery pack and the electric powertrain, which is really what Mission Motors is focused on. I look at that powertrain, and I compare it to where we were 15 years ago. The battery pack in the Mission One motorcycle, which is actually very similar to the one in the Chevy Volt, is it would have cost over $25,000 back in 1995. Just looking at the batteries, we're not even talking about packaging or anything else. Just looking at the cell technology, now we can do it for under $6,000 with technology that exists. Okay, that battery pack in 1995 would have taken up 15 gallons worth of space. Today, it takes less than six. That battery pack would have cost or would have weighed over 270 pounds, and now it weighs less than 140 at the cell level, just talking about the batteries. The technology is improving every single day. Basically, what we see when looking at that comparison to 1995 is the electric motorcycle that we're building was not possible a decade ago. It could not exist and still be realistically called a motorcycle. But that being said, in actual answer to your question, Kerry, we still have a long way to go. The cost is still too high. And the focus of our business is how do we take that leading-edge technology, the supply chain that we're working with, and continuously optimize the performance of these vehicles, improve the range, get more value out of every dollar that is going into the vehicle, and improve the performance for the driver or the rider.
Thank you, Jit. Here's a question that's directly relevant to that point from one of our audience members who says, I rode here on an electric bicycle, less than 1 cent a mile, parked right outside, and I made BART's inadequate network usable. A little editorial comment there from someone about BART. Why aren't we also talking about electric bicycles? And of the five of us, you're probably the one that knows the most about electric bicycles. Is that a feasible concept? And how do I get one?
It is very much a feasible concept, and there are companies here in the Bay Area that are producing some really fun-to-ride, very functional, will get you to work and back electric bicycles. And for those people who are interested, I highly recommend them. They're a lot of fun to ride. I think what we have to do is appreciate the reality of the American driver context, right? Once again, our focus as a motorcycle company is the riding experience. We want to create a riding experience that is different from everybody else. But to solve the problem as a whole, we need what Tony is doing. We need what Richard is doing in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of producing that mass market car that everybody can drive, and not just to work and back, but also on the weekends, that can actually begin to displace the gasoline vehicles on the road. So here, I think what you're going to see is you'll see more adoption of things like electric scooters and e-bikes. They are here and they're present. They're available. But in terms of solving the problem in the United States as a country, we do need to solve the problem of the car.
If I could just piggyback a little bit on one of Jit's comments, and this is the taking the technology to scale. So you get cycles of learning, you get more competition, more commercial money, more VC capital, more innovation. This is where I think the industries play together. Jit said it very well. The cell technology and the way the batteries are constructed are not too different. Certainly the duty cycles are a little different, environmental conditions, some of the regulations and standards are different. Really, what one of the things that the Chevrolet Volt is designed to do is to find a solution with its extended range capability to make this a mass market car. I did some calculations, and I can't quote the exact volume number, but it's not too far off of where our target is, where General Motors could literally become the single largest procurer or purchaser of active lithium-ion materials, exceeding all the PC companies and the like, and gets back to Jit's comment as to the different levels of cost as we're seeing them come down. So I think there's a tremendous synergistic effect if we look at this technology. As Richard stated, you know, there is really some interesting energy diversity and energy security aspects of it. So I think, if you may pardon the pun, that we on this panel are quite charged up to see it happen, and we've seen the future, driven the future a little bit, and we think it's very, very possible, very possible.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. The subject is electric vehicles. Our panel is Mark Duvall of EPRI, Tony Posowatz of General Motors, Jit Bhattacharya of Mission Motors, and Richard Lowenthal of Coulomb Technologies. Go ahead, Richard.
Just one more word to that, which is the infrastructure that we're putting in, the charging stations, for instance, downtown San Francisco, all have provisions for lower speed vehicles. So every one of ours has two different ports on it, one for the vehicle connector and then another one which is basically the household connector for the electric motor, scooter, the low speed vehicles and electric bikes. So we're putting this infrastructure in. We expect our stations to stay in the ground for 25 years because we know this is going to evolve. And yes, the leading edge are some high-end products like Jit has and like Tony has, but this will be a pervasive change in transportation.
One of the things that I keep hearing about electric vehicles is that they are inherently simpler and should be cheaper to manufacture. And yet what I've noticed is that the electric cars out there seem to have a price premium on them. So my question for Tony Posowatz is, when will the electric vehicle a cost equation drop below that of the internal combustion engine, and how cheap could it get, really?
That's one of the million-dollar questions, obviously. I think one of my previous comments related to when we have some scale, when there's commercial activity, when some of the brightest and smartest individuals from research institutions and companies and R&D departments focus on this, we think you'll see some significant improvement. For example, if I focus just on the battery technology, and many of the white papers had quoted that the going rate is about $1,000 per kilowatt hour. I know, and many of my other manufacturing brethren who are introducing vehicles now know that that has already been bested by a significant factor, almost by a 2X factor. Technology in general, whether you use the examples of memory storage for computers, cellular phone technology, et cetera, usually takes a couple generations to drive down. with a Chevy Volt because we still have an ongoing extended range feature, an engine generator set on board. The absolute cost of that type of vehicle probably won't get below a conventional vehicle. But as stated before by Jit, Richard, and others, the benefits, we think, far exceed the costs, if you will. But I think we'll see a lot of interesting inventions. I think by Gen 2, you'll see an ability for manufacturers to break even on this technology, and not too far after that, you'll see us making money, and then a lot of good things will happen relative to future innovations and cost reductions.
I'd like to add something to that, is that, and this is something that has to happen in the mind of the vehicle purchaser before electric vehicles can truly be successful, and that is that if you go out and buy any mid-size car today and you keep it over its reasonably useful life, you're probably going to buy a minimum of $15,000 in gasoline for that vehicle. So that factors into the price. And in many cases, you could literally pay for the car again in gasoline. And we really have to understand when we go to make those kinds of purchases that you're weighing a little bit more expensive vehicle. And electric, I would dispute that electric vehicles are simpler. They're all modern vehicles are incredibly technologically sophisticated. So just because you don't have a gasoline engine or you have a smaller gasoline engine doesn't mean that your vehicle is simpler. It just means that it has some extra things and doesn't have a few other things. So I think ultimately you can't really understand what the vehicles are going to cost until they're made at high volumes, you know, minimum of 50 to 100,000 vehicles per manufacturer in a calendar year. So we're a ways out from understanding that. So in the midterm, what we need is rapid adoption of the vehicles that are available, and then really understand what all of the benefits are, not just cost, because leather seats and DVD players for the kids in the back row, those things don't pay back over time either. But we get them because we want them. So really understanding what the benefits are of the technology and understanding that it is extremely important. There's probably, as an individual, few decisions you can make more fundamental than what car you purchase in terms of environmental impact. So if you switch from a gasoline vehicle to an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid vehicle, it really can have a very strong impact on your own environmental signature.
Here's a question from the audience that I'll direct to Tony Posawatz. Which technology will be the mainstream for the future vehicle, the plug-in hybrid or the pure electric?
I think the future will be blended in that it will be good for all of us to see these competing technologies. I think one comment I'd like to make when we discussed about where the source of energy comes from to fuel the electric grid. The beauty of the electric grid is there's so many different pathways from the renewable sources, natural gas, nuclear, geothermal, water, et cetera. And this creates some interesting competitive situations. The Chevy Volt was constructed in a manner to make that leap to get to a mass market electrically driven vehicle. We've called it an extended range electric vehicle or electric vehicle with extended range capabilities. It is quite modular in the respect if technology and battery cells improves. In other words, if power and energy density improves or costs come down and we can get more and more range, and we can make this car more and more affordable, it's quite conceivable that the Volt could morph into a battery-only vehicle. Or the modularity associated with how big the battery is, what size gas tank, what liquid fuels you use to support your extended range feature. In the future, the Volt will also have an extended range capability to use biofuels and flex fuels. So it's hard to say which one will win. I think allowing them all to compete and doing enabling technologies like General Motors is doing, we are building our own battery packs. So we will get some very specific knowledge and expertise to hopefully someday do another battery electric vehicle. We think the Volt for the near term to drive a mass market revolution is a vehicle that it is not only for the enthusiasts, it is not only for the early adopters. We think it is a car that everyone could grow to fall in love with.
Thank you. A follow-up question for you. This was from the audience, Tony. Do you envision a future where the car itself, via advanced photovoltaic materials, charges its battery from solar power?
Very good question. Full disclosure, we studied on the Volt. Did a very, very detailed study. And there are a few manufacturers that have an optional photovoltaic roof on the car. We came to the following conclusion based on the prevailing technology, the alleged high cost of the car, which we didn't want to increase any further, that the best place for capturing solar would be in a position like a home or another installation that would be able to get solar all the time. I'm not sure how much solar we get when the car is garaged. I'm not sure how much solar we get when the car is under a shady tree. And again, the extra cost in mass, we are absolutely in favor of and supportive of and taking a lot of initiatives on to make certain that the charging that will help facilitate driving electrically in a Volt will come from green electricity. And there's a bunch of initiatives we can talk about at a future date. But we really think that the best position of photovoltaics is to be part of a larger installation, whether a home installation or some other more significant installation, and the Volt will gladly capture and store in its battery that green electricity.
Thank you.
If I could just add a little bit to that. We have stations in Chicago that are all solar-powered, and basically there's solar panels out there all day. There's a battery underground that's being charged off those panels, and when it comes to charge a vehicle, we discharge those batteries into the vehicle. Similarly, in Hawaii, we have stations that are completely wind-powered that have no grid tie at all because they have such consistent wind power there. So we do still have ways of getting entirely locally generated clean energy into the vehicles.
Yeah, I would like to add quickly to that is that those are really two separate issues. Solar, the roof of a car is really small, so unless someone comes up with a really, really good solar panel, it only collects so much sunlight. There's only so much there to capture, so it's really too small. But a lot of folks who have electric vehicles today power them with solar panels, and that's great. But those are two individual choices. If you decide you want a solar panel, you want a solar panel. If you decide you want a car, you buy a car. You shouldn't predicate buy an electric car saying, now I've got to go get my renewable energy from somewhere.
Right.
California has an amazingly aggressive and ambitious renewable portfolio standard for the electric utilities in California. So the utilities here are doing everything they can to get more and more renewables into the grid as fast or faster than they can reasonably do. So the renewables are a lot different from just buying the car. So you should be able to buy the car without feeling you have to go out and do this other thing. You want to do that? That's great.
At one point, I was thinking of buying an electric motorcycle, and I was in the process of having photovoltaic panels put on my roof, and my vision was photovoltaic panels on the roof going to charge my electric motorcycle, so which I can ride to BART. But then I studied the math. I applied my MBA skills and discovered that I was a lot better off selling that peak time energy to PG&E at the top tier rate than I was using it to charge my bike. And so I wound up with the solar panels, but not the bike. Anyway.
The bike would have been more fun than the solar panels.
You're right. I never even see those things. A question for Richard Lowenthal of Coulomb Technologies. This is from the audience. I know you've answered some aspects of this already. What does the infrastructure look like today across the country for recharging e-vehicles? Where would I go today to recharge, if I were in Denver or something, how would I recharge my e-vehicle?
So it's interesting. The early adopters, we think, will probably be the type that want to hide their car away in the home garage. And so most of your charging, I think, for the early adopter will be in the home garage. I'm kind of an exception. I do primarily my charging at work, and my employer My landlord has charging stations, two charging stations in our lot. They're becoming a normal piece of parking lot furniture. So several of the high-tech companies now in Silicon Valley are putting in charging stations as a normal course of business. And Dell Computer made a big splash by putting in both solar panels and charging stations together as to encourage their employees and visitors to use clean transportation. But we see it throughout the valley now in the high-tech firms. We see hotels have them, McDonald's have our stations, so they're beginning to spring up. The federal government is trying to get this kick-started by using stimulus money this way. So they've already awarded about $130 million in the last 6 months to help get this started. The reason being, in a place like San Francisco where there are so few home garages, you might not think you have the opportunity to buy the Chevy Volt and use it, so they want to get it kick-started here, because without any of Tony's cars, people won't put in the infrastructure, and without the infrastructure, you can't buy his car. So we are getting a little boost from the federal government, and Fortunately, when you buy a charging station, it puts three people to work for a day. So the federal government is interested in using stimulus money in that way.
Thanks, Richard. I'd like to address this audience question to Jit. You have spoken of the technological advances in batteries in terms of cost, weight, and so forth. Can you speak to the recyclability and the toxicity of the batteries as they get more and more powerful?
Sure, and this is a really important question because it's speaking to the broader issue of sustainability. And when we talk about renewable energy, when we talk about vehicle electrification, we need to start thinking about the entire cycle, the full system. What's going to happen to these batteries at their end of life? And there's going to be a lot of batteries if the electric vehicle revolution takes off the way that all of us are talking about. The one thing about lithium ion that is a benefit compared to the incumbent technology, which right now is really nickel metal hydride. That's the style of battery that you see in the Toyota Prius. Lithium ion is less toxic. It is easier to recycle. That being said, large scale recycling of lithium ion batteries is still something that is in development. Now, there is a lot of research going on, and a lot of this is happening through the government labs I know about, but then you also have companies that are starting to look into it, is can we take these batteries at the end of their life and potentially use them in other applications? Can we use them to do renewables firming for the grid? Can we use them as ancillary services for the grid? And what are the possibilities around that? There's a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of challenges. But it is an interesting opportunity for how we can actually take the lithium-ion batteries at the end of their life when they're no longer useful for the car and still get a lot more value for them down the road. It will help with renewable energy at the grid level. It will also help reduce the upfront cost of the batteries for the car.
Thank you.
Terry, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
As I stated earlier, General Motors also is manufacturing and assembling battery packs. So we, too, have pondered this very important topic that JIT raises. And one of the things that we've done with the Chevy Volt is the Chevy Volt has gone on record that our performance target for its long-term performance is 10-plus years in the car, 150-plus thousand miles. What that indicates is you want to, in order to have a sustainable system for this new technology, is make its life in its primary application as long as possible and then take care of that product, that battery, so that it does have a secondary use, as JIT indicated. The interesting point of note, the end of life for a battery in a vehicular application is when it reaches 70% of its capacity. Well, that's kind of interesting. There's very few things that I throw away when I still have 70% of its use available. In the case of a Chevy Volt, I've liquid cooled it to temperatures that people like. I condition it to the degree that we condition people in a passenger compartment, if you will. So I think that bodes to the point that JIT raised. I think it's something that we have to collaborate on, look at those secondary uses, work with Mark and the team at EPRI, and then obviously as the costs and the like come down and the applications come down, I think the basic fundamental science and physics around the way the battery packs are comprised make them quite good candidates for recycling, to recapturing the lithium. Lithium is quite easy to recapture. It's generally in a form of a lithium carbonate, so it can be separated and the like. But to JIT's point also, there aren't a lot of commercial applications because there are not a lot of batteries that are at the point where they need to be recycled. So we are working on it, I think, along with JIT and others and the battery manufacturers. I think you'll see more on that in the future. But I think the key point is the longer you can extend the life of the battery and ready it for a secondary use, the recycling issue becomes very much pushed out in the future and planned for, if you will.
Thanks, Tony. Question from the audience about the smart grid. I'm going to address this to Mark Duvall, since that seems to be more of an EPRI question. In 25 words or less, what is the smart grid? And how does it relate to electric cars?
If I could say that in 25 words or less,
right,
they would promote
okay.
me.
I'll give you 50.
The smart grid looks exactly like the electric grid serving your home or your business now, except that it consists of a bunch of devices that can talk to each other. And when I mean talk to each other, that doesn't mean measure what's going on and feed it back to a central community. It means that they talk to each other. It means that the meter at your house knows the cost of electricity. It it can talk to your refrigerator, talk to your dryer. It can send you messages on your iPhone. It can help you manage your electricity. A trivial fact about electricity, and not the smart grid, so it doesn't count against my words, is that electricity as a commodity has gotten cheaper every year since the inception of the electric industry until last year. It went up for the first time. And that is because we have a lot more, there's a lot more investment needed to modernize the grid, to meet new environmental requirements, to plan for a future where carbon emissions are limited. And so electricity will get gradually more expensive, not like we're used to seeing with gasoline and oil prices spiking up and down. So it will be key for the users to be able to manage their electricity. And the smart grid helps you do that, and it helps the electric utilities run a much more efficient system. And the more efficiently they operate, the lower all our rates are. So that's just something very important to note about it.
Right, thank you.
Could I just relate smart grid a little bit, though, to just this application? Because I think it's vivid to see how it can affect cars. In most of the utilities we have in the U.S., there's some time where there's a peak load of energy which drives the size of the generation and the capacity that the grid has. And California is one of the best examples of that, because we all turn our air conditioners and pool pumps on in the afternoon in the summer when it's hot, and we nearly run out of electricity. So what the utilities will do is to inspire all electric vehicle drivers to charge their car at night when they have plenty of capacity, they'll have a differentiated rate. So that it'll be cheaper to charge your vehicle at night. Then either using smart features in Tony's car or using our infrastructure, you can tell the vehicle or the charging station, get me the cheapest energy. I just need the car at 7 in the morning. Get me the cheapest energy, and then I'll take care of it, or Tony will take care of it. And it'll save the driver ultimately as much as $800 a year in lower energy costs. And it's just incentive pricing we see from the utilities, because they want us to charge off peak.
Thank you, Richard. Here's a sort of related question from the audience, related to the challenge a homeowner would have in getting a charging station put into his home. How is the permitting system changing to allow for suitable charging units in the home?
Yeah, it's got a lot of work to be done. I think Tony or Mark will weigh on this too. But the situation now is not so good. You know, when I bought my Mini, it took a month for me to get a charging station in the home. But we see how to get it done in 4 days. In a pretty straightforward fashion, and down to as much as 1 day. So we're working on getting that down to 1 day. The situation now is you need to get a building permit. You need to get a site inspection to see how difficult your home might be. Then you need to get a building permit. Then you need the station in put in place, and then you need an inspection. But those things can merely be all done in 1 day, and we're working hard. It's one of the issues that we need to solve. So that the day after you buy your car, you'll get a call from one of our installers saying, when can we put a station in your home? And then they can do it on one visit. So that's the goal. We're far from it today, but we can get there.
Yeah, it's important not to be too afraid of installing the charge station. It's an appliance. It's like a clothes dryer or like a spa. Some homes, it will go in easily because you have space in your electrical panel and you have a conveniently located garage. Modern homes, generally, newer homes. Some houses, older houses, you have to do a lot more work, and so the expense can vary considerably. And it's important. Cars are parked at home two-thirds of the time, so that residential charging, this whole industry doesn't go without mastering that residential charging.
It's interesting, and one of the reasons why the Chevy Volt will come standard with a 120-volt cord set, or what we call an EVSC, electric vehicle supply equipment unit, is so you can, in fact, take advantage of the grid as it stands today, the size of the Volt battery, and the smarts we have in the car. So literally, when you take a Volt home, you can plug it in and charge it overnight, 8-9 hours using 120-volt, and because you have the range extender. To Richard's point, we're working together, because if we can solve the delicacies and detail associated with developing lithium manganese spinel cell chemistry and packaging up into a battery that started at one day as a cell phone cell, if we can make that work in a harsh environment like an automobile where there's temperature changes, humidity, dust, debris, it's really a violent environment. If we can make that work, I think we can work on the permitting too. Huh?
Yeah, we'll get there.
One of the things that's been talked about, the upside potential for electric cars in the homes and, you know, and everywhere, is the idea of supplying electricity from the vehicles to the grid through this so-called smart grid and so forth. So the question is, how far away are we from that? And each of you can take a crack at that. Is it reasonable any time in the future to expect that a homeowner could wind up getting paid for supplying power to PG&E overnight or during the day if his car is sitting there?
Well, I'll take it first. Everybody's going to want to say something probably about this. But our charging stations will do that. We design our stations so they're bidirectional. Every one of ours has a meter in it, so we'll know if you put energy into the grid or take it out. And so all those things you can do with a solar panel about measuring, doing net metering and seeing whether you're providing energy to the grid or vice versa, you can do with our stations. But the real question is, do you want to use that asset in your car that way, the battery in your car? Because there is some life. Tony talked about what happens in 10 years or 150,000 miles or so when the battery doesn't have the capacity it used to have. And the question is, for the homeowner, what's that worth? And is it worth enough to use your battery in that way? And I think we're a ways off from that. We have right now, I think we really want to use that battery to fuel your vehicle and get you to work and back. And so let's look at that a little bit later.
Yeah, well, I'll speak about this for a little bit more from the technology side of things, and that is, Richard really touched on, do you want to be using your battery in that way? And as a vehicle manufacturer, when we're looking at these electric vehicles, knowing that the batteries have a finite cycle life, that's a big question that we are trying to answer. And it's still going to take a lot more data. It's going to take a lot more understanding. More than anything else, it's going to take vehicles in the field. And that's something that I think a lot of manufacturers are working toward. The one thing that goes without saying is that the more data that we have, the more intelligence that we have around these systems, the more we are going to be able to optimize. And creating that bidirectional system of communicating with the grid, of communicating with the home, those are critical features in order for us to optimize the use of electric vehicles and make them really functional within the way that a driver is dealing with them.
Let me try a different perspective representing the Chevrolet Volt team and how we're looking at this thing. First and foremost, to make this new electrified vehicle era work, we have to make the cars work. We have to make the batteries last. And kind of to the points that Richard and Jit made, those are the first priorities. And if that doesn't work, then much of the long-term vision that we seek out won't happen. But let me share with you a couple of quick stories here that relate our focus area in this regard. We think there's tremendous value to providing the capability to load manage, load shed, peak shave, whatever terminology you want to use, electric vehicles when they are taxing the grid during the day, as we talked about, and Mark said it very well. You'd want to charge these cars overnight when the grid is not being utilized, when you're sleeping, when the car's not driving. That's the primary charging episode and situation. But if you are charging during the day, wouldn't it be nice then to offer that capability to the grid and perhaps even create some value and monetize that capability? We have an interesting technology on the Volt called OnStar. It's something that we've developed for 14 years at General Motors, and it's a huge enabler for us to create a smart car to talk to the smart grid, to talk to the smart appliances. And let me cite with you a real quick example, and then we'll let Mark close this out because he's the most qualified to talk on this subject. Today, our OnStar telematics wireless platform can send a signal to assist authorities in a stolen vehicle high-speed chase and literally depower the car to avoid a high-speed chase and apprehend the criminal. I recently saw a video that showcased a police trooper pulling up behind a car. He had his movie or video camera on, and it watched the guy try to scramble through the sunroof, and we sent a command to lock the sunroof out to apprehend the crook. So given the capability we have today, I think in a stationary vehicle to stop a charging event, if a utility asks us to do so because it's the middle of the August and 3 in the afternoon, is something that we would gladly afford and provide that technology to, because the health of the grid and this relationship that we're forming with our new fueling partner is very, very important. So, Mark?
I think that everyone that works in the electric vehicle industry, whether you're on the utility side or the car side would say, or the motorcycle side, the vehicle side would say, that it's important that the batteries first run the wheels, drive the wheels, and that we then look at more advanced things. So I think the first step is really to establish what we would call smart charging, and it's kind of a corny name, but you'll hear it again and again and again, which means that we will synchronize how these vehicles work with the electric system so that we'll be charging off-peak. Utilities will be designing low rates to encourage drivers to charge off-peak. Today, if you are a PG&E customer, you can get an off-peak rate for your electric vehicle at 6 cents a kilowatt hour. That's like buying gas at about 50 cents a gallon or less. So that is really as close as you will ever come again to driving that inexpensively. So these are really good steps, and they set us off to do something in the future. Solar energy at the home, residential solar energy, was very good at allowing people to start to become power generators. You use the grid to store your electricity because at noon, when your solar panel's at its highest output, well, chances are you're at work. So you don't really need that energy. So you put it out on the grid and then you ask for it back later that day and you pay the difference. So with electric vehicles, there could be something like that in the future. But first, let's get as many out on the road as possible and get the cost down and really understand what makes this industry go. And then by then, we'll understand if that makes economic sense, because it's still not clear that you can sell power back to the grid through your car, pay for the equipment, liability, other things, and still have it be profitable. That's still not clear.
Thank you. Mark Duvall of the Electric Power Research Institute. Here's a somewhat challenging question from an audience member, specifically for Tony. Tony, if we look at the specifications of the Volt, it is obviously overbuilt. More battery capacity than it will use, larger electric motor than it needs to power an average sedan, etc. Does this mean that we may see this platform used in other vehicle applications? So is this questioner true? Is it valid what he's saying? And answer his question.
Certainly the Volt is built with a lot of capability. We put a lot of our most precious talent and treasure into the Volt program. And it's really built on the shoulders of many of our other efforts. We could have not done the Volt program if we had not done an EV1, if we had not done a fuel cell, if we have not done the hybrid program General Motors had done, if we had not taken the initiative to look at the various biofuel options and the like. So certainly we feel the Volt is a very, very capable engineered product. And to Jit's point, I'm going to punctuate a very important point, that the fun-to-drive element of this car is incredible. There's a few people in the room that are smiling at me right now that drove the car this morning. When I talk about instantaneous torque, no transmission shifts, the eerie quiet of a car that is just gives you a whole different peaceful experience. In a Volt, we've set this thing up to have a wider track. The center of the gravity of the battery makes the ride and handling experience even more incredible. But back to the question, the Volt is not a singular play for General Motors. We chose an existing vehicle platform or architecture, a parent vehicle, so that we could perhaps build other models on it. And if they happen to be a bigger model, a crossover SUV or whatever, the capability that exists in the propulsion system has to be able to propel a vehicle like that, a bigger vehicle. So these are things that we're studying in the future. We haven't finalized as to what happens after Volt, but General Motors is sincerely and absolutely committed to create products that are electrically driven, that build off the learnings from the Volt. But everything has to be built on a successful Volt, and that's why the Volt really has really specifications that we think will delight customers. When you're driving 0 to 60 in 8 seconds and may have the capability, if you get more than one charge a day, of perhaps never using fuel on an annual basis, and we talked about the cost benefits, we think there's a lot of opportunities in the future, so stay tuned.
Thank you, Tony. I have three interrelated questions from the audience, all for Richard, having to do with charging. So get ready, Richard.
I'm ready.
How do people pay to charge at one of your stations? I'm going to give you all three questions.
Okay.
How do people pay at the charging stations? And are there different requirements? Do some vehicles need a different kind of charging than others? And how do you handle that? And finally, how long does it take if you're in a public charging place? How long does it take to charge the car? And does that make sense from, like, if you're shopping or something?
So, good question. So, first of all, how do you pay? Our stations have the ability for you to pay with a credit card, and you can either use a sort of loyalty card like Fast Track works, where it takes money periodically out of your credit card, or you can use a credit card by calling a toll-free number, or you can use the wireless credit cards. But it's a little bit unusual. Most of the owners of the stations won't ask us to collect money. So most of the stations you're going to encounter will actually be free. These are people incentivizing you to use their parking lot, or maybe it's your employer, or maybe it's your local grocery store who wants you to come and visit and stay for a long time when you charge your vehicle. So we're going to see a lot of free. We leave that up to the station owner, whether they want to charge or not. If they do, it goes by credit card. And you swipe this little RFID tag at the station, and it knows who you are. So what were these other questions? Sorry.
Are there differences between the cards that arrive at your charging stations?
Great. So the U.S. fortunately has standardized on a connector for the vehicles. And so the vehicles that you'll see from the major manufacturers will have the same connector on it, which allows you to use a public infrastructure. If you were a driver like I was 10 years ago in the trial in California, you'll remember there were really four different standards out there, which led to some difficulties. But fortunately, we don't have that case now. There's a standardized connector in the U.S. So that's good. We're not quite there in the rest of the world. Our shipments are only 50% in the U.S. And, for example, in Italy, as you might expect, they have six different connectors, which are all quite elegant. But they haven't quite licked that problem. But it's good in the U.S. You won't have a problem with that. With regards to charge time, the cars generally, sort of on average, if you put them in a pool, they take about 4 hours to charge from completely depleted to completely full. But you tend not to do that. In an average day, you drive 29 miles. And so that takes much less time. You're talking now more about maybe it's an hour of charging a day that you'll do. You won't even notice because it'll be where you park anyway. And will it help to charge while you're at Costco? Well, it'll help Costco because you'll linger longer. But it does help the car, too. And these batteries have no memory, so everything you can do to keep the batteries up is good. I always leave my car plugged in when I'm at work. That way I've got the full range of the vehicle anytime I want to go somewhere during the day. So we tend to think of now charging as part of the parking experience. If you're going to park, you charge. That way, you've given up the pleasure of going to the gas station, and you need to park anyway. So it's just a part of parking.
Thank you, Richard.
We did a survey several years ago about how people would view charging, because at that time the common wisdom in the auto industry was that it was be seen as an inconvenience. So I got to plug this car in every day. And out of that survey, 7 out of 10 people said that they would strongly prefer to charge at home rather than go to the gas station. 1 in 10 people did say they would prefer to go to the gas station. So it takes all kinds.
Weirdos, obviously.
Candy bar.
Here's a question looking from the audience, looking down the road a few decades. The question is, are there limits to electricity becoming the solution to greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector as a whole? Are there any parts of the system that where it might not work?
Well, let me tackle one piece of that, which is the limit on the vehicle end. One of the nice things about electric motors is they're about 90% efficient, which compares to a gasoline engine, which is about 20% efficient. So your gasoline car has a radiator, and most of the gasoline you put in the car goes up as heat out of the radiator. And you'll notice EVs don't have that, and that's because most of the energy that goes in the EV spins the wheels. So this is a very, very efficient way to move the vehicle. There still is, as Mark said, a lot of work to be done on generation. But as far as a vehicle, it's a great way to move you around.
Thank you. One of the things that keeps coming up when you're talking about electric vehicles is battery swapping. So you're driving along and you run out of juice in your battery, and so you pull into a station and the gas station or the service station person will take your battery out and put another one in, and then you can go on your way. So I'm paraphrasing this audience member's question, so I'll just keep doing that. So what does it take to make that kind of a network of battery swapping stations work?
So I'll talk at this at the risk of talking about one of my competitors. So the biggest challenge first is the interchangeable battery, and as much as JIT and Tony love each other here, there's a, I don't know, maybe it's a 5-foot-long T-shaped battery in the Volt, and it's not going to fit in JIT's motorcycle. And so the interchangeability of batteries hasn't really been worked out, and so far there's just one manufacturer that wants to have this swappable battery. So you've got to get the automakers to agree on the new D-cell, which we haven't quite gotten to. The second piece of that is the big challenge in converting to another fuel, and we've seen it with hydrogen, is building out an acceptable infrastructure so you can go anywhere you want. And the reason electricity is nice is that Mark has already made it so we have electricity everywhere. And the reason that gasoline or the other fuels that Tony's vehicles is good as a fuel for the long-range trip is that we've got gasoline everywhere. To get these battery swap stations everywhere is very, very difficult. We expect to be able to refuel every 30 miles. That's a lot of those things to get built out there. So it's just a tough challenge to deploy in the U.S.
I think you'll hear more about this. There's a company in Silicon Valley working on this. You'll hear more about two things. One is battery exchange. The other is called fast charging. So fast charging is, instead of pulling into one of Richard's stations and charging for a few hours, you would pull into a much larger station. And it would directly pump energy directly into your DC energy directly into your battery. And you could charge in maybe 30 minutes, maybe. If you just needed to get home, it could be 5 minutes. So it sometimes is called quick charging, and they are ways to make electric vehicles more usable. And they both have some merits. However, they are expensive, very expensive technology, and they force you to create an infrastructure that looks, you look at a map, that looks more like a grid, so evenly spaced on a map in order so that I can drive anywhere between all these different points and have a charger somewhere. Whereas if you want to pump the most electricity into vehicles, you look at clustering. So the chargers are located where the people are parking, which means at home, at work, in shopping malls, so dense urban areas. And no guy wants to own the charger that's halfway between LA and Barstow and try and make money off that because only one electric vehicle passes there every couple of weeks. So the challenges of making that grid are really, we would have to figure out, because I doubt you can do even one of them fully, let alone both types of technologies. But you'll hear much more about it. It's not a settled debate.
Or you can have an extended range feature on your vehicle.
It's gasoline.
And utilize one of the 170,000 existing refueling stations until battery technology and infrastructure is in place.
Why am I not surprised that Tony Posowitz would make that comment? We've reached the end of our time. You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, a panel on discussing the electric vehicles. Our panelists are Mark Duvall of the Electric Power Research Institute, Tony Posowitz of General Motors, JIT Bhattacharya of Mission Motors, and Richard Lowenthal of Coulomb Technologies. Today's program is being underwritten by the Mineta Transportation Institute. I am Carrie Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.